Now we're going to spend some time talking with one of our favorite regular guests on the show when we get into discussions about the Trump-Russia investigation, about what the Trump administration is up to in general. We like to visit with Sarah Kendzior, the author of The View from Flyover Country and the co-host of a popular new podcast called Gaslit Nation. Sarah, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You bet. Let's get started right from the beginning here with Matt Whitaker. Let's get your thoughts on this appointment that the president has made to replace Jeff Sessions.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously bad. Whitaker is obviously somebody who should not be in this position due to various conflicts of interest and immoral impulses. But the same was true of Sessions. I never felt that the Mueller probe was safe in Sessions' hands. You know, Sessions was said to have recused himself, but didn't actually recuse himself in practice. He went ahead and fired Comey. Sessions was implicated in the Russia probe, having illicitly met with many Russian officials and oligarchs during the campaign and then lied about it on his clearance forms. And this is in addition to, you know, domestic atrocities that Sessions had perpetrated. So when everyone kind of freaked out about Whitaker saying, oh no, you know, the Mueller probe is in danger now, what will we do? I felt like they were feeling what I've been feeling for the last 2 years, which is that, you know, the Mueller probe and the investigation into Trump and Russia in general was never safe. It wasn't safe under Sessions. It's not safe under Whitaker. It won't be safe unless there's an independent commission investigating it. And I think at this point, our best bet is the Democrat-led House Congressional Intelligence Committee trying to, you know, put together the findings and actually bring some accountability into play, because it's certainly not going to happen under Whitaker. I think they're going to try to shut the whole thing down before the Democrats take office.
There's been an expectation, you know, since Election Day, clearly it was believed or felt that Robert Mueller was adhering to this rule of thumb of not influencing an election by releasing any information or running any indictments that last 60 days or so before the election. But since then, expectation has been that the other shoe is about to drop and there's a lot more to come. Are you in that camp? Do you think we're about to see something happen?
No, I don't feel like anything's going to happen. I don't want to say I've given up on the probe completely, but I don't think it's being handled with the urgency that is necessary when you're dealing with an autocratic, criminal, aspiring empire that's rapidly consolidating. You know, Mueller has been very lax on the U.S. Side of people implicated in this investigation. The only person who's seen repercussions in a serious way is Manafort, and he nearly didn't because of his trial. And now, of course, he has pled and said he would cooperate. He's not actually cooperating with Mueller. This is the same thing that happened with Papadopoulos. You know, he pled guilty and said he would cooperate. Then not only did he not cooperate, he impeded the investigation, faced no consequences for that, just got 2 weeks in prison. He's probably going to have a book deal or a TV show. I mean, this is not being run very well. You know, Flynn was indicted, I believe, about a year ago. He still hasn't been, you know, sentenced or brought to trial or had anything happen. Roger Stone has a track record of crime so long that to detail it, I'd be on your show for several hours. He's still running around. Others like Michael Caputo, who were involved in the beginning, are CNN pundits. Like, there have not been repercussions for these crimes against the American people. Mueller is simply not bringing them. And I think people felt hopeful that maybe, you know, he wanted to obey protocol, not influence the midterm elections or be seen as doing so, although obviously Comey had no problem doing that. But we saw nothing last week after a lot of hoopla and people saying, oh, and indictments are on the way and Assange is going down too, and then nothing. So, you know, it's possible that something will happen. Whether it will happen in time and whether the results of what Mueller is doing will be revealed to the public, I think are other issues that I'm worried about as well.
Yeah, and there is the possibility that he could prepare a report that none of us will ever see.
Yes, I think that is probably the Trump camp's strategy. It's not so much to fire Mueller, because I do believe that will bring widespread public outcry. You know, you already saw that after Sessions left, where, I mean, I think no one really wanted to be protesting the departure of Jeff Sessions because everyone hated Sessions, but, you know, they were worried about the integrity of the probe, and so they were protesting, you know, firing under unjust cause and, you know, basically trying to stand up for Mueller. So I think what they're most likely to do is let Mueller keep plodding along, knowing that he's going to be the sort of by-the-book institutionalist that doesn't seem to grasp the urgency of the threat. And then, you know, Mueller may well produce an incredibly thorough, well-researched, high-quality investigation that no one will see and that the public won't get to know about, that won't be acted on in Congress. And the people who engaged in this crime, of which there is evidence all over the public domain, will face no repercussions. And that's the worst outcome, I think, even worse than firing Mueller, because it is a perpetual gaslighting of the American public. It makes it impossible to call for another investigation, because they'll just say, oh, we already investigated and everything turned out to be fine. And, you know, that's what I think their plan is, just run out the clock.
And yet, with the House flipping and with so much pent-up anger, you know, from people like Adam Schiff, who will be taking over the House Intelligence Committee, don't you feel like that new factor is going to upset that apple cart as far as any ability just to let it all slide?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I think that that's the bright spot, and they seem committed to the truth. And they were very early on this. You know, they were talking about this in 2016, trying to get to the bottom of it, but held in check, of course, by GOP domination of Congress. And so I do think that with Schiff in charge and with, you know, other members of this committee, you know, having worked on this for 2 years but not been able to exert the sort of influence that they wanted to, that has potential. I definitely don't think people should be, you know, putting all their hopes on Mueller, but maybe looking toward, you know, the Democratic Intel Committee as a source for illumination on what happened, whether, though, it will actually be acted upon in terms of criminal charges and in terms of just stopping the damage that these people are doing to our country. You know, people who are implicated in it, like Jared Kushner, who should certainly not be in his position and who's caused a tremendous amount of damage already, or Ivanka Trump, you know, they need to be out. And the unwillingness to even pursue that really has given me pause.
Yeah. One of the other expected actions or possible actions with the change of control in the House is that there's now a potential to access Donald Trump's tax returns. If that were to happen, what do you think we would learn?
I think a lot of the most damning things about Trump's finances won't necessarily be in the returns, but there will be gaps in those returns, just sort of unanswered questions that then you have to dig into to find out, you know, if he had this many expenses or he spent this much money in this year, how exactly did he pay for that? I think we're probably going to see a lot of evidence of debt. We're going to see a lot of things that don't match up with information in the public domain, either what he says he earned or, you know, investments he's made in buildings, especially overseas. You know, this is a guy who's been involved, it seems, in money laundering for several decades. I want to know, you know, where have these tax returns been for the last 40 years? Why no one leaked them during the election? You know, this is a very leaked full election, yet somehow this didn't come out. There is a report in a Czech newspaper that released documents dating back from the days of the Czechoslovakian security services, you know, which collaborated with, at that time, the Soviet services. They're interested in Donald Trump because of his marriage to Ivana Trump, who came from Czechoslovakia, and they had a number of documents saying that Trump had struck some kind of deal, it didn't specify with who, to not pay taxes for the next 30 years, this would be from 1977 on, and that this would ultimately culminate in him becoming the president. And this is what happened, and this was not written in some, you know, weird tabloid, this was in The Guardian. These were, you know, federal documents from the Czech Republic that were released there and translated into English. And when that story came out, I thought, how is no one following up on that? Because that's literally the case. Like, he didn't seem to pay taxes. We didn't get a chance to see his taxes. And now he became the president in a rather unorthodox fashion. So, you know, I'd like to know if such a deal existed, who was involved in it, and how in the world does somebody strike that kind of arrangement with the U.S. government over multiple terms and over an entire generation? I mean, it's just absolutely bizarre.
It certainly would be. That's Byzantine. Recent developments, for those who aren't familiar with the work that you've done, you've studied authoritarianism and strong men, and, you know, there's all different kinds of terms for people who take power. We've seen this sort of, I don't know, falling of dominoes or an effect where around the world now, more of this type of leader taking charge, and the most recent is Brazil. How far back do you track this process, as it were, and, you know, how did it get started, and does it run its course naturally? A lot of different questions mixed in there.
I think it's hard to tell. I mean, traditionally, when you look at a worldwide rise, you know, in fascist or extreme right-wing movements, it often comes after economic collapse, you know, and after wars. Like, this is the same situation you saw in the 1930s where, you know, after World War One and, you know, a lot of international disputes that weren't actually resolved by, for example, the League of Nations or other outcomes of World War One, you know, then you see kind of similar to the 2000s, the 1920s, this kind of overspending, this sort of, you know, bubble boom time that collapses, and you end up with the Great Depression, and in our case, you end up with the Great Recession, and, you know, those conditions are just rife for the rise of fascism in all sorts of different places. So in one sense, this is a familiar story, but I think that the rise of the internet and of digital media have really changed the game, because what you're seeing here are transnational alignments, you know, of authoritarian leaders. And, you know, yes, of course, we've had that in the past. You know, we had Axis powers, but we're finding advisors, people like Steve Bannon, just traveling around the world, you know, going to Brazil, going to the UK, going to Israel, going to all of these different countries to try to prop up the most, you know, extremist right-wing players, and then using these incredibly complex social media technologies, whether Cambridge Analytica or the abuse of existing networks like Facebook and Twitter, you know, whose CEOs, of course, go along with this and enable this, that allows the spread of authoritarian ideology as well as just conspiracy theories and lies and hate rhetoric on a level that we've never seen before, and I think it's been very effective, and people have not found a way to stop it, in part because this isn't just state power being applied, it's, you know, corporate monopolies, and people don't feel like they can opt out of, you know, Twitter or Facebook or these other sources, so they're just bombarded with propaganda on a day-to-day basis. So that poses a new problem for humanity that I don't think we're doing a very good job of solving.
Yeah. We're talking with Sarah Kendzior, the author of The View from Flyover Country and co-host of a new podcast called Gaslit Nation. And I know that when we talk about these issues, it's complicated. There are a lot of names and topics that get involved. And if you want to start to pull it apart and understand it, the Gaslit Nation podcast is a resource you can certainly use. There's some things that happened in this midterm that, you know, are seem to be shaking things up, and the question may become, will they really? And one of the shakeups might be that being too tight with Russia may not be something you want to carry into a campaign in the future, as we saw with Dana Rohrabacher losing his seat after decades and being, I think you described him as a Russian asset the last time we talked. This friendliness that we saw typified by that group of senators that was in Moscow on the 4th of July, is it fabulism for us to think there's something going on when a group of American senators spend American Independence Day in Moscow?
No, I think that's a legitimate question to ask, and the fact that they would do it in the midst of, you know, multiple federal probes into illicit activity between American politicians and Russian kleptocrats and oligarchs is a serious question. I mean, they're being very brazen about it. It's worth noting that Trump's first visit to the USSR and he was recruited over there was also on July 4th in 1987. So there's kind of a pattern there. They also brought over, U.S. officials on 9/11. You know, they pick days that have sentimental value to the American public to kind of just, rub this in. And, you know, I think what we need to be looking at, because it'll probably yield the greatest results on a practical level, is financial ties, campaign contributions, the role of Russian or other dark money in campaigns. I certainly think Rohrabacher was a beneficiary in that sense, and it's very good that he's gone and is, you know, replaced with somebody who will be accountable to the American people instead of accountable to Vladimir Putin. I definitely think that, you know, being an open Russian asset or, you know, at the least a Russian lackey is not going to win you many votes among the American public. But I think there's also just broader frustration with the GOP, with Trump, with the direction the country's going. And I certainly think people made their voices heard in the midterms this year about that.
Yeah, for sure. The most recent accusation that I've seen of someone who's too cozy with the Russians, and this, I don't know if there's anything behind it more than just one small thing that I saw, but it was aimed at new Representative Ocasio-Cortez and sort of a blanket thrown over her and Bernie Sanders and the Democratic Socialist kind of movement, saying that, well, these people don't have much criticism of Russia. They don't feel like the Trump-Russia investigation is very important. Is that accurate in your perception?
I don't think that's accurate about Ocasio-Cortez. I haven't seen her, you know, say anything either way. And I think that she's a new congresswoman who's been focusing on the issues that she actually knows pretty well, like income inequality, climate change. If she were directly asked about Russia and, you know, were to say, oh, I don't think there's anything to it, I'd have some serious questions about it. But I don't think that the absence of commentary about a subject that, you know, isn't really exactly her wheelhouse, is that notable? Because I can think of many congresspeople, you know, who have done the same. You know, Sanders is a case that I do have questions about, mostly because of his voting record. You know, he voted against the Magnitsky Act, which was, the act to sanction Russia over human rights violations, not once, but twice. And each time he was one of only two senators to do this. You know, this is a broadly popular bipartisan initiative, which, as we know, in America doesn't happen that often. So, you know, I have questions about why he did that. I have questions about Ted Devine, who was his campaign manager, who also had ties to Paul Manafort and to Yanukovych and Ukraine and was hooked up in some bad stuff. I don't think that necessarily means that Sanders himself is, you know, directly or voluntarily implicated in it, but it does seem like people in his circle are. And so that's certainly worth investigating. And if I were either of them, you know, I would want to know the roots of this because, you know, people have this misunderstanding that the Trump-Russia case is some sort of, you know, foreign or espionage affair that doesn't affect real life. But if you're concerned about autocracy, about white-collar crime, about oligarchy, as both Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez claim to be, then they should certainly want a stop to this. These are the same plutocrats that are destroying American life. You know, they have counterparts in Russia as well as in other countries, and they're working in tandem, and they're making the lives of ordinary people across the world absolutely miserable. So this is a cause they should get on board on and help bring Trump accountable.
Hmm. A lot of people, and last question, I know we're almost out of time here. A lot of people are pointing right now to this Interpol situation and the potential for Putin to have essentially control of this international crime investigation organization. Is that of a concern to you? I'm thinking the answer is yes.
Well, it's a major, major concern. Like, this should be a huge story. They're currently targeting Bill Browder. When I mentioned Magnitsky before, Browder was the person who helped bring about the Russian, the sanctions against Russia because of Sergei Magnitsky and is an enemy of the Russian state. And so now we essentially have the mafia, running the network that's supposed to target and bring, to accountability organized crime. There was also a lot of troubling things that happened before with the old head of Interpol in China, you know, who seems to have been kidnapped and threatened and then stepped down. And so, you know, to me, this is a signal that you have, you know, global kleptocracies led largely by Russia, but with, you know, participants from around the world that are rigging the mechanisms of accountability and justice. You know, you certainly see this in the U.S. with the packing of courts. And this is basically it on an international scale. And it's not just that people won't be prosecuted, which they need to be. It's that Interpol can be abused to target people like Bill Browder, who's a human rights activist, and accuse him of crimes that he never committed. And so that's a very dangerous tool for Russia to have in its hands.
Once again, Sarah Kendzior, author of The View from Flyover Country and co-host of Gaslit Nation, which is a podcast you'll find wherever you get your podcasts from. And Sarah, thank you again for being on the show today. Non sequitur conclusion, happy Thanksgiving.
Oh, thanks. Happy Thanksgiving, you too.
All right. Talk to you again soon.
Bye.
It's 5 minutes before 8 o'clock at KVON. Time for a little break here, heading toward the top of the hour and some news. And following, we are planning to talk with another writer. His name is Matthew Simon, who's written about the reckoning that we're dealing with in terms of climate change. He's done a piece for Wired on that. We hope to connect with him in just a few minutes and talk about that topic. So stay tuned. More to come here on the KVON Morning Show.
It's beginning to sound a lot like Christmas. This holiday season, Lincoln Theater